Mary Stein here today to talk to us about ethical space and policy making, advancing the use of Indigenous traditional knowledge in community planning in Canada. And I think this is a really exciting topic from a Canadian perspective, because this is very much reflective of an emerging and long overdue conversation that we need to have as a society in Canada around our relationship with Indigenous peoples. And I think it's increasingly a conversation that's happening more broadly too, and has important parallels with some of the conversations you might have had in courses around decolonizing public spaces, decolonizing the curriculum, for instance. So Perry's going to talk to us a little bit about his experience working as a community project community planner and project manager at Aaron Owen Consulting, which is an Indigenous-owned consulting firm that works out of Calgary, and he'll tell us a little bit more about what they do exactly.
Sure.
But he has a longer trajectory working in urban and rural planning, community planning in Canada, as well as internationally. So I'll hand it over to Perry. We'll do about 45 minutes, is it? Okay. Where Perry's going to talk to us, and then we'll have about the same amount of time for questions. Okay.
Awesome.
Over to you, Perry.
Thanks, Lily. And thanks everyone for taking time out of your evenings to come and listen to me talk about things I enjoy talking about.
That's always fun.
So, Haley introduced the name of the presentation, so Ethical Space and Policy Making, Advancing the Use of Indigenous Traditional Knowledge and Community Planning. I always like to start my presentations with a bit of a purpose statement. It helps everyone understand what the trajectory, what the narrative arc of the presentation is supposed to be. Really, I'm hoping to introduce a few concepts. Reconciliation is not a Canadian concept or a concept unique to Canada, so I'm going to try to introduce it from a Canadian perspective, along with a few other terms that maybe you have heard of, maybe you haven't heard of. And to really unpack those terms, I'm going to relate them to some case studies from a few different Indigenous and Canadian cultural geographies. So I'll build a little bit on Haley's introduction. This is my daughter, so you can look at her face instead of looking at mine for a few minutes. So my background is as a planner and a community engager. So I have a background working in public sector, working for local governments in a rural, regional, urban, and Indigenous community context. I also have worked as a planner in kind of different types of planning outcomes. So working on environmental projects, working on legislative projects, working on heritage and culture projects, working on intergovernmental communication type projects. So I have, an interesting kind of multifaceted background, and so I'm hoping I can answer your questions in the presentation, but I will let you know if I can't. I'll try my best then. So in terms of the narrative arc of the presentation, I'm going to start with a brief description of an Indigenous context in Canada. I am not an Indigenous person. I'm not an expert in Indigenous affairs or cultures or geographies in Canada. I have a tiny bit of information that I can share, but please don't take this as the only truth. There are multiple truths. I'm hoping to give you a bit of an introduction into this, and that you can then go and take and learn more information. After we kind of have some fun with some maps, and we'll talk a little bit about the truth and reconciliation journey in Canada, what its origins are, what some of the pathways, different levels of society, different levels of government, different individuals have taken, and what reconciliation, how we might define it in a Canadian context. I have a few other key terms that I want to introduce, and really all of this is leading us to the last part of the conversation, which is about really practical examples of how we've taken Indigenous knowledge, Indigenous ways of knowing, and incorporated those into a land use planning policy kind of a conversation. So, I didn't have this at the beginning of the presentation before, but I think it might be useful. These are the geographies of the four case studies I'm going to give you. So, I'm going to start in Lethbridge, which is where I live, a city of about 100,000 people. We're going to talk about a project that looks at Indigenous traditional land use from a heritage conservation perspective, and how that can be used to inform policy making and land use planning community planning in that city. We're going to look at a post-secondary institution in Calgary, sitting at about $1.2 million, and how this institution is undertaking a project to indigenize the university, the campus, and all aspects of it. We're going to look at a very large infrastructure project in Edmonton, which is a city of about 900,000 people, very complicated political geography, and how that city has incorporated traditional knowledge into an assessment of right-of-ways for a transportation project. And then we're going to finish up looking at a project on the border between Ottawa and Gatineau, which is a city in Quebec, and see how a private land developer is incorporating traditional knowledge into an urban redevelopment project in an incredibly complicated geographical location. So this is where we're going, and so now we can go back and we can start the beginning. So you're not going to be able to read anything on this map, and that's okay. The next slide I have a little bit more of a kind of an inset map of this province, which is Alberta. So this is, in Canada there are three, let's say categories, but that's a pretty loose term, of Indigenous peoples. There are Inuit peoples, there are Métis peoples, and there are First Nation peoples, and all three of those groups have constitutional recognition and protection within the Canadian context. They have very different histories, they have different geographies. This map shows the location of First Nations in Canada. I'm going to probably stick to the word Indigenous because I think it's a more inclusive term. In Canada, the Constitution refers to that collective of those three peoples as Aboriginal peoples, but that's a term that often excludes people who don't neatly fit into those boxes. For example, people who don't have official status, called non-status. But this just gives you a really broad overview of how incredibly busy the map is in Canada. We have nearly 2 million people self-identifying as being Indigenous, nearly 5% of the population. Of just the First Nation communities, there are over 630 different communities in Canada speaking over 50 languages. So Indigenous Canada is not a monolith, it is not one cultural group. Even within the cultural groups or language groups, we have incredible diversity and variation. There are relationships between First Nations communities, and for that matter, Inuit and Métis communities, to other geographies, for example, in the US or in Greenland or in Alaska. The neat kind of line along the borders kind of hide the fact that there's a lot more deep history of interconnectedness. Here's a subset. So we're going to talk about a project in Lethbridge, we're going to talk about a project in Calgary, and we're going to talk about a project in Edmonton. So even within this relatively small landscape, to put it in context, so if we were to draw a line from Calgary to the border with Montana, which is about here, and cut off this province, this is about the size of Portugal or Austria. It's a relatively large area, and within that we have cultural groups from many different backgrounds. We have Dene communities, we have Stoney Nakoda communities, we have Blackfoot communities. There's just incredible variation, each with its own story, its own worldview, its own cultural, its own language. And I think this is important because I think most Canadians actually don't understand that. I think they see Indigenous peoples as being one people as opposed to, you know, over 630 communities. Here's another map, perhaps a map that suggests something older. This is a map of shared Indigenous territory. So this is a map based on or created by a nonprofit organization called nativeland.ca. They have maps like this for other parts of the world, so not just Canada. And it shows to you we don't like to say overlapping or conflicting territories, but shared territories of different communities. A few of the examples we're going to talk to involve the Niitsitapi, the Blackfoot peoples, in kind of this area. We're also going to talk a little bit about Anishinaabe Algonquin communities in kind of the border between Ontario and Quebec in this area. There you can see in the top we have Inuit communities into the northern part of Canada, the northern part of Quebec. So this would have been prior to the arrival of European settlers through a process of kind of settlement, and we can put that in quotation marks, and land claims, treaties. This is kind of the geography we start to see emerge, the political geography. We can see some of the earliest treaty making that happened in the 1600s to more modern day treaties taking place in, you know, near Vancouver or in the north in the last 10, 20 years. So the process of, again, quote unquote, settling the land and creating divisions of land is something that's ongoing. So if we were to go back to this map, we see a lot of shared territory. It suggests the trade of economic goods, of cultural goods, of peoples, of languages, sharing history, sharing story. Then we have the artificial creation of very strict boundaries. The example I can give is the Blackfoot people. So I suggest on this map, this is one group that we're going to pay attention to a little bit because it's going to come up often. Their traditional territory went, you know, it's hard to put it into terms that maybe everybody understands, but an incredibly long distance. So from the city of Edmonton that we had in the beginning, all the way down to the Yellowstone National Park in the U.S., east to west, several hundred kilometers. Through the process of treaty making, we see that that territory gets constrained and constrained. And even within there, the reserve system, now we have this community broken apart into smaller communities and put into reserves that are very small. So this is the largest reserve in Canada, a community called Gaynon, which is about 1,300 square kilometers, which is roughly the size of New York City or Greater London. So people using a territory probably the size of Britain, now using a territory the size of London. So, and from a perspective of cultural traditions, carrying on linguistic traditions, accessing resources, trading, that constraint really is the product of a process of, you know, human genocide, but also cultural genocide, which we'll talk about shortly. So this is kind of my home political geography. This is where I live. I'm surrounded by the largest First Nation reserve in Canada, both by geography and population, a population that's growing twice as fast as the population growth of the rest of Canada. So we're seeing a resurgence, not just in kind of Indigenous concepts, but actually in population too. The other thing that I want to suggest, and this is something that is not, I think, common perspective in most of Canada, but I think it's slowly becoming, and I think some of the case studies I'll present will kind of suggest why that's the case, is our city centers, our big cities, are also Indigenous communities. So this is Calgary. If anybody's familiar with Calgary, you can kind of see, I don't know if there's a pointer on here, but in the top, just kind of below the downtown core, there's a river, that's the Bow River. In Blackfoot language, that downtown, the intersection of that river and another river called the Elbow River is called Mokinstis. That means elbow in Blackfoot. This area is called Nose Hill. There's 9,000 years of historical occupation of this land that is far older than the 120 years that the city of Calgary has been there. This is the oldest known archaeological site in the Calgary area. It was it's a relatively high plateau, so it was free from glacial ice much faster than the rest, has unique flora and fauna. It's also an important vantage point looking out into the rest of the area and west into the Rocky Mountains. So it was an important kind of scouting location or campsite, camping location for Indigenous people for thousands of years. Calgary also has an urban Indigenous community of 30,000 people. So this was an Indigenous landscape far before Calgary is here. In fact, Calgary is here precisely because it was an Indigenous landscape. Most of the city centers in Canada are where they are because there were trading forts that were established at those locations, often because they were near the intersections of waterways. And those forts were located there because that's where the Indigenous people were gathered and have gathered for thousands of years to access resources, to practice ceremony, to practice their culture. This is another Indigenous landscape, another one of our projects. This is Lethbridge. So this is a city of about 100,000 people with an urban Indigenous population of about 15,000. So 15% of the community self-identifies as being Indigenous. It's also about 50 kilometers from one of the oldest archaeological sites in Canada, which is 13,000 years old. So people have been using this landscape for at least 13,000 years, if not longer, suggesting this is also an indigenous community. And here's another interesting example. This is something that's starting to become more commonplace in Canada with the creation of the reserve system through different treaty-making activities. Those lands are under Crown ownership. So there's no private property ownership in First Nation communities in Canada. So of those 630 communities, they're all in Crown land. Through the treaty-making process, there's obviously some, it wasn't always so above board, let's say. There's a lot of historical federal government employees selling portions of reserved land to settlers, to farmers. And so over the last several decades, there have been ongoing land claims signed trying to make whole those reserve boundaries that have been kind of cut back, or to compensate for federal mismanagement of Indigenous community lands. So one of the ways that this land claim process happens is that financial payments are given to First Nation communities, a portion of which is allocated to the purchase of new lands. So historically, First Nations would have purchased lands immediately adjacent to their reserves. What we're seeing more and more of is actually First Nations purchasing lands within big cities. So this is Winnipeg. Winnipeg has a population of about 700,000, and 100,000 people in that city self-identify as being Indigenous. So this parcel of land, roughly kind of this maybe half city block, is actually Crown land. This is a First Nation reserve in the middle of Winnipeg. And there are dozens of examples of this. One of the universities in Canada called First Nation University just became an urban reserve about 3 weeks ago. It's the first kind of education-focused urban reserve in Canada. And there are unique economic opportunities created through reserves that aren't always available through kind of fee simple or private property ownership lands. So what you often find in kind of these urban reserves is housing agencies, education agencies, economic development agencies owned by First Nations, kind of making a presence in a community to increase economic opportunities or social welfare access or whatever it might be for their urban members who are living in that city. So if there are 100,000 Indigenous people living in Winnipeg, it makes sense for a community who has, you know, 5,000 members living there to have a presence, to maybe have an election voting booth, you know, for every 3 years to increase turnout for their election. So that's kind of a very brief Indigenous context from the perspective of land use planning or geography. The next piece that I want to introduce is what truth and reconciliation has kind of looked like from a Canadian context. So really this journey started from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, which completed its works in 2014. Other countries have had Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, obviously. Canada's is really focused on the experiences of residential schools, which was an institutional policy of the government of Canada in partnership with many different churches and religious organizations to essentially incorporate Indigenous peoples into the Canadian context. So to remove, there's a famous quote by somebody who would later become our first prime minister, to remove the Indian from the child. That was the intention. So really this is an exercise of cultural genocide. We see it's not just about kind of anglicizing in many cases or Christianizing students. There were 130 different schools across the country. The last one just closed in 1996, so this is something very recent. There were over 150,000 children who were removed from their families and sent to these schools. And these weren't like schools down the road. Oftentimes, these were hundreds of kilometers away. Children would try to escape. They were not allowed to practice their cultural ways. They couldn't speak their own languages oftentimes. Their clothes, when they arrived, would be burned in front of them. No access back to their families. So really, while on the surface, this was presented as a way of kind of creating cultural, creating a homogenous culture in Canada, this was about physical and emotional and sexual abuse. It was scientific experimentation. There was malnutrition, and, you know, as the next slide I'm going to show you, or two slides from now I'm going to show you, this is about cultural genocide. This is a slide that we like to show our audiences in Canada because it really sinks this message home for them that you're more likely to die as a child in a residential school than a soldier in World War II, which is quite astonishing. And I think this is a story that's just starting to become told in Canada. Many people have no awareness of this. You know, even talking to my parents where I am, their understanding of what residential schools was basically nothing. This wasn't common knowledge among anybody. So I'm going to quickly play this. This is a video of the three commissioners of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, or the TRC. Three commissioners of the TRC. This is kind of the press conference where they announce their final reports. It's only about 2 minutes, but I think it can give a lot better emotion and kind of storytelling than I can about what this is all about.
This has been a difficult, inspiring, and very painful journey for all of us. The residential school experience is clearly one of the darkest, most troubling chapters in our collective history. In the period from Confederation until the decision to close residential schools was taken in this country in 1969, Canada clearly participated in a period of cultural genocide. We heard of the effects of over 100 years of mistreatment of more than 150,000 First Nations, Inuit, and Métis children placed in these schools. Removed from their families and home communities, seven generations of Aboriginal children were denied their identity. We heard how, separated from their language, their culture, their spiritual traditions, and their collective history, children became unable to answer questions as simple as, where do I come from? Where am I going? Why am I here? And who am I?
At least 3,200 students sent to residential schools never returned home. In almost one-third of those cases, the student's name wasn't even recorded. A quarter of the time, the student's gender was not recorded. For almost half of the students who died, the cause of death was not recorded. The indignity of this, the utter sadness of this, the parental devastation of this, can you imagine? These deaths were in part the consequence of a lack of government funding. But mostly the causes of death found root in the same attitudes that enabled the schools to exist in the first place. A belief that Aboriginal peoples were inferior, a belief that they did not warrant investing in richly, a belief that their culture could and would be extinguished.
There was an attempt to destroy our culture. Our cultural events and ceremonies were prohibited. We were abused for using our own languages. But if we are to heal, we must return to spirituality. The seven most powerful words that we learned from the survivors in our hearings: I'm sorry, I love you, thank you.
The sacred fire lit at sunrise a few days ago will be extinguished soon in the coming days. And now we must light a fire within ourselves. And we must let our conviction, our courage, our commitment, and our love keep this fire burning. As commissioners, we have described for you a mountain. We have shown you the path to the top. We call upon you to do the climbing. Thank you.
So the point now is to, we've kind of given a bit of an overview of context of, you know, what is the political geography of Indigenous Canada, what are the instigators of the Truth and Reconciliation journey. There was a moment in that video when he said the word cultural genocide and people started to applaud. That was a big deal. The first time that a federal commission acknowledged that this was a act of cultural genocide was powerful. From there, we've had a series of institutional apologies. We've had apologies from different provinces, from the federal government, even different post-secondary. For example, the University of British Columbia last year made a formal apology for its role in instructing educators to then go and work in these residential schools. But apologies from different church groups. That, along with the legal settlements from this, really have laid the foundation for healing which has taken place, which has really led to kind of different societal conversations at, you know, the level of the individual to, you know, like an elementary school, to a province, to the federal government, to professional organizations or disciplines, thinking about what reconciliation means for them. So the perspective that I'm sharing today is about what planning, what land use planning or community planning has embarked upon from the perspective of reconciliation. And we have a few, you know, more specific tools that have come out since the TRC finished its work. The first was something called the Calls to Action. So in Canada, when the commission finished its work, they released this report called the 94 Calls to Action. It really was Justice Sinclair talked about, we've described the mountain, we've shown you the pathway. This was one of the pathways that was shown of the 94 Calls to Action. It was kind of a guidebook for different sectors of society, sports, private business, all levels of government, the justice system, healthcare, education, some suggestions of what reconciliation should look like. That plus, I'm not sure how familiar some people are with the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The last gentleman with the cowboy hat, Chief Wilson Littlechild, he was actually one of the pioneers, kind of the instigators of the creation of the UN Declaration about 30 years ago. So really, we've had a number of tools. We had the TRC Calls to Action. We had the UN Declaration, both of which have instigated something. So many levels, as I mentioned, many levels of government, many institutions have started to do some work. So here's a couple of examples. We have one of our example cities, the City of Lethbridge, has done the Reconciliation Implementation Plan. We have the City of Calgary released the White Goose Flying Report, named after Jack White Goose Flying, who was one of the students who died at the industrial school that was in Calgary. And we have my professional body, the Canadian Institute of Planners, just released this maybe 3 weeks ago. This is the Policy on Planning Practice and Reconciliation. This is a suggestion of what the role is that planning has had in the legacy of colonization in Canada. So that's everything from creating communities and raising lands and removing, you know, perhaps artifacts from those lands, or segregating Indigenous peoples from urban or community environments. And so what should planning do to reconcile? So that's kind of an introduction to Truth and Reconciliation in Canada. Now what I'd like to do is introduce a few other key terms, and then we can jump into the case studies. So the first term is traditional knowledge. This is from the World Intellectual Property Organization. This is how they define traditional knowledge. It's kind of our textbook definition. So knowledge, know-how, skills, practices, developed and sustained and passed from generation to generation within a community. And we have two different ways. We have kind of a general expression of traditional knowledge and a narrow expression of traditional knowledge. Generally, it talks, you know, it's about embracing the content of knowledge itself. So this is, you know, music, dance, art, designs, names, performances, ceremonies. These are general expressions of traditional knowledge. From a Canadian Indigenous perspective, this might be a specific ceremony or a specific song, an oral history, tool making. From a narrow perspective, this is about knowledge that results from intellectual activity in a traditional context. So this is through thousands of years of presence in the landscape, what are the specific pieces of knowledge that are generated? So this could be everything from agricultural knowledge, scientific knowledge, technical, ecological knowledge, medicinal knowledge about where to find resources, knowledge of herd movements, harvesting, hunting, farming, or the medicinal application of herbs that are found in a traditional territory. So when I talk about traditional knowledge being incorporated into land use planning, this is kind of what I'm talking about, the different expressions of traditional knowledge. The next And I thought I'd throw in a picture that everybody here might appreciate. So, the next kind of parallel topic is decolonization and indigenization. So I feel like, and this is my kind of understanding of how I use these terms, is decolonization is really the act of removing systems and structures and oppressive systems and structures or colonial systems and structures or knowledge dominances and creating the space for something else to emerge. Whereas indigenization is kind of the act of reasserting and filling that space. So indigenization, so indigenous knowledge and worldviews and ways of knowing already exist. They aren't being recreated, but they're being given the space to actually take over some of the space being given up through decolonization. And so when we talk about this through the work that we do in our firm and some of the work that I've done previously, we have to kind of emphasize how omnipresent colonial structures are, because we often just take them for granted. So even the way that we present information as being truth, being factual, the way we kind of orient ourselves in an environment, even like this one around the boardroom table, even the way we design architecture and public space, all have kind of linkages back to colonial systems of dominance. And for my profession, the planning profession, when we think about the way we design a community, or we design a building, the way we design a neighborhood, we often approach that work as if there's a blank slate, there's nothing there. When in fact we know that there are thousands of years of history, there are linkages back to the formation of knowledge and worldview and storytelling, science. And so this act of indigenization really is, again, creating the space for those worldviews, perspectives, and knowledge bases to take back the geography from which they come. Next term, and I'm not sure how, this is kind of a term that's becoming increasingly used in Canada. I'm not sure how far it's kind of spread its wings, but ethical space is really kind of that nexus of maybe decolonization and indigenization. So from a Western perspective, this is kind of how I imagine it, like a Venn diagram. Ethical space is that space in the middle where multiple worldviews, and we have to remember that an indigenous worldview is not one worldview, it's multiple worldviews. So the space where we have multiple worldviews coming together and they exist where information and expertise can flow in both directions. So it's not just the Western dominant worldview telling the indigenous person how to educate their children. Or it's not just an indigenous community telling a municipal government or a local government how to plan their neighborhood. But there's a space in which all forms of knowledge can be seen as being beneficial when they come together. This is my suggestion. Again, I'm not an indigenous person, but from my conversations and the work that I'm doing, this is kind of how I imagine perhaps an indigenous perspective on ethical space. And the idea of braiding knowledge systems comes from Dr. Leroy Littlebear, who's a Blackfoot scholar at the University of Lethbridge. And he talks about braiding worldviews together. I think it's quite interesting because the act of braiding doesn't assume like a mixing pot or a melting pot where everything comes together into one new thing. Like braiding together is about individual strands of knowledge coming together in a way that actually strengthens all of the knowledge bases, but only in that act of coming together, but that nothing is lost from that home knowledge system. And finally, so reconciliation, we talked about this a little bit. There is no, I think, real definition. It's about personal experience, personal context, and the act of doing all of those things, decolonizing, re-indigenizing, creating ethical space. And this is going to mean something different for, you know, me and the work that I do, or my former colleagues who I used to work with in museums or archives, and what how they approach reconciliation from the work that they do. These are just, I suggest, some suggestions of different organizations doing this work in Canada right now. Reconciliation Canada is a big one. It's a nonprofit organization that came out through the TRC process as a way of providing toolkits to everyday people to do reconciliation. They created a little back pocket reconciliation guide that you could, you know, come up with ideas and put in your back pocket and walk around and make it real every day. The National Center for Truth and Reconciliation is kind of the repository of TRC work and archives and where we have the academic information, it's housed at the University of Manitoba. And this is just an example of one professional organization, the National Trust for Canada. I know there are national trusts in this part of the world too. And they're starting to explore what reconciliation looks like for them as an advocate for heritage in Canada. I guess this is the last term. So last term, I've been using this a lot, and I thought before we move on, it would be useful to actually explain what land use planning means, because I think community planning or urban planning in a Canadian context is actually quite different from even a UK or a European context. And in Canada, it's much more about engaging in policymaking, whereas over here, it's more about the architectural design or urban space design. There are aspects of that in Canada, but the majority of planners at home are more kind of, they act as this hub of the meeting point of different disciplines, as advocates for outcomes, as opposed to maybe designers of space. So planners really serve as that intersection between, for example, engineers, transportation designers, human service agencies, recreation, culture, finance, and take all that information to still look to enter to advocate for some sort of outcome. And this is quite simplistic, but I thought it was useful, and so we'll come back to these kind of four different aspects of planning and when we get to the case studies. These are kind of the four critical things that I think is the work that I do that defines planning. So the first is engaging, so doing communications and engagement, going out and meeting with stakeholders and interested groups, understanding needs, understanding realities, distilling information, taking information from multiple sources, and determining, weighing those alternatives, coming out with some sort of a policy suggestion to a decision maker. And that, you know, that could be the process taken from a planner who works in social policy, a planner who works in environmental policy, a planner who works in transportation policy, taking information from different, your stakeholders are going to be different, your sources of knowledge are going to be different, and your decision makers are going to be different, but really that cycle of policy making in this perspective is relatively constant. So again, this is kind of our Canadian geography of the case studies. It's a big country. So this is the first example. This is the traditional knowledge and use assessment in the city of Lethbridge. So again, Lethbridge is about 100,000 people, about 15,000 of which would self-identify as being indigenous. It's located to next to the largest reserve by land area and population in Canada. And it's predominantly within the traditional territory of the Blackfoot people. Unlike the other case studies that have perhaps more contemporarily shared territories, Lethbridge is firmly both in the relationships that it built as a city and the people who live there, it's quite dominant in terms of being Blackfoot. So this project was really about trying to survey the landscape. If you remember that picture before, they had the river valley and the bridge crossing. This is a city whose geography is dominated by this river valley. This project was really focused on understanding indigenous traditional land use and occupancy and historical sites, places of special significance from a ceremonial perspective, a burial perspective, storytelling perspective, and understanding where those places are in the city. The thing that was quite interesting about this project is that typically when a city goes out to understand its history, you know, it hires architects or historians, archivists. This project, we actually hired the consultation departments of the three Blackfoot nations in Alberta. So we went to the sources of knowledge themselves. We didn't hire an archaeologist to go and find this information. So it was a fundamental change in terms of who is the owner of information and how that information is brought to, in this case, the city. This is the first time that any Canadian city has done this. This has never been done before. The city went out and sought information from the knowledge keepers themselves, the elders themselves, and did an assessment of the entire city. Typically, what would be done is, if you had a new river crossing, a new bridge over a river, you would do an assessment along the right-of-way of that bridge, a very narrow assessment. But what we know about history and culture is that everything is interrelated. Everything is contextual. You can't tell the story of a significant plant species found on the south-facing slope of a river valley without understanding how that plant was used, maybe the ceremonial site where that plant was incorporated into spiritual practice. Everything is connected. So by understanding the cultural geography of the entire city, we have a lot more context. And that was used as an entry point into future land use planning and decision making. So when we're creating a plan for a new community that will be home to 20,000 people in the next 40 years, it's better to have that assessment done prior to planning and prior to decision making, so that information can empower stronger planning and decision making at the outcome. I wanted to kind of highlight some of the innovations, I think, from each of these projects. So that the first one is really the source of expertise in this project being the indigenous communities themselves. It's hard to understate how important that is and how fundamentally different that is. That's never been done before from a municipal government context. And then the new layer of information that I'm going to say is created, it's not actually created, but the layer of information is created that can then plug into the way that planners and decision makers exercise their work. So this is a new layer of information that can be drawn upon. And finally, there's two ways, getting back to those land use planning aspects of engaging, distilling, et cetera, there's two ways that traditional knowledge was incorporated into that process. The first is engaging. So again, who was engaged to gather knowledge? And this connects back to ideas of territoriality. So by engaging with the Blackfoot on this project, it reaffirms from a Western perspective the traditional presence of the Blackfoot in a territory, in a geography outside of the reserve. So if you go back to that first big map of Canada, I showed all the little green and purple and gold dots that show First Nation reserves. The majority of Canadians would believe that Indigenous peoples have always lived in those little tiny postage stamps, when in fact we know that traditional territories were sometimes tens of thousands of square kilometers large. So the exercise of engaging people in geographies beyond their reserve communities is not only important from the Indigenous community perspective, but it also is important from the average resident of the city's perspective, who then starts to realize that they live in an Indigenous community. The second way, and I've kind of talked about this already, but it's the way that we distill information. So the places that we're drawing knowledge from are fundamentally different on this project than any other heritage project done before. So we're not just looking at paleontologists or archaeologists or historians as so-called experts of heritage. We're drawing the knowledge from elders and knowledge keepers in this Indigenous context. Before I move on, I think I have a little video I want to show from this project that I think reaffirms this. It kind of will help describe the project as well. And this is actually kind of exciting. I don't know if we created this video after this project won an award back home, and we showed it in a conference. And it was, I think, the first time that in this kind of institutional context that anybody had heard or watched a video that had absolutely zero English being spoken. So this video is entirely in Blackfoot, which is kind of powerful. And I think it's actually interesting, given where we are right now, how powerful it is for this video to be shown entirely in Blackfoot in the home of the colonizers, right? So I'll have to share that with my Blackfoot colleagues at home.
Segundo ele, olha esse sustento, né? Que era esse ideal, esse tipo de. No saco, isso que nem tem na licita de o cacita, esse o suíta, esse sacumita, esse somita, esse. No saco, o que é que o tio da dona da Augusta, esse tipo de idade, esse no saco.
This is interesting. The So these are elders and knowledge keepers from, these guys are from Cana. And these are the archaeologists taking notes. So they're not the ones who own the information. They're being asked to take notes and to document things that the elders are saying are important. And so what typically happened on this project is that, kind of like a historical perspective, is that Neil and Alyssa, the archaeologists on this project, would go out and look at the archaeological survey of the area and say, these are the facts. This is where you buried somebody. This is where there's a teepee ring. This is where there's a rock cairn. Now on this project, he goes by Super Dave. I forget Dave's last name. He's telling Neil about how his people historically use, you can't see, but there's a whole stand of cottonwood trees over here. He's telling Neil how his people used that land and how they took the Saskatoon bush branches and used those to make the ribs for a sweat lodge because they bent really nicely. So he's telling him all the information, and Neil's now the assistant. Good to have videos to break up the monotony of a presentation. So that's the Lethbridge example. The Calgary example is a post-secondary institution called Bow Valley College that has been doing an indigenization strategy for the last year or so, and we've been helping them out with kind of implementing how they've engaged their faculty, their staff, their student body, their partners in the community. So the indigenization strategy has a couple different kind of facets. The first is how to update the curriculum to be more truthful of Indigenous experience, and how to incorporate that knowledge into a variety of their programs, justice studies, nursing, and health, and education and arts. It's focused on improving the relationships between the institution and the actual Indigenous communities themselves, how to recruit more Indigenous students and faculty and staff, and ensuring they actually stay at the university, and to ensure fundamentally that Indigenous people feel welcome and included in the campus. So that's connecting back to the way public realm is designed, the way that people acknowledge traditional territory when they begin a presentation. So there's about 15,000 students at Bow Valley College, although the broader audience of this project really is the entire city of Calgary. There are two other very large institutions, University of Calgary and Mount Royal University, probably have 45 to 60,000 students collectively. Many institutions and many post-secondaries in Canada are also undertaking these indigenization strategies at the moment. So from our perspective, it seems to be less about the decolonization strategy, more about an indigenization strategy. So it's a bit of a more of an empowered perspective, I think. The challenge with this project, and this is a challenge with other projects too that I'll talk about, is the idea of territoriality. So it's not just one Indigenous community that's being involved in this project. There are the Blackfoot, there are the Métis, there are the Stoney Nakoda, or the Dene, each of which has its own historical presence in this region, and conflicting narratives, maybe not conflicting narratives, but different narratives of time and space. And so the challenge for Bow Valley College in this case, but other you know, proponents who have projects in these shared geographies is how, whose knowledge system should fundamentally guide the work? Or how do you create the space for multiple knowledge systems or indigenous communities to guide the work? So the fact that Canada is not a monolith of indigenous culture makes this very, very complicated. And more recent kind of assertions by different communities of what their political geography is and historical geography is has made this very, very challenging. The other aspect of this project that's quite interesting is it's created these opportunities to hear firsthand from Indigenous people about what the opportunities are. So we're shifting from a deficit model to a strength-based model. We're not just talking about the challenges faced by Indigenous people, the barriers they face, or what they must overcome to be students, for example, at this university or this college. It's what are the opportunities presented to you through an Indigenization strategy to showcase your knowledge or to tailor your education to meet the needs of you in your home community or to meet the needs of you in this urban context. This is kind of a narrative that's happening in a lot of institutions in Canada, primarily maybe health and education is shifting away from being deficit focused to being strength focused. And again, I think that's about indigenizing things as opposed to decolonizing things. So this isn't a typical kind of land use planning project, but it has a lot of similarities. The pieces that I think are quite innovative of this project are the fact that Indigenous peoples themselves are the leaders of this project. So the two project proponents, the project managers at the college, one is Inuit and one is Métis, they're the ones who are designing engagements, reaching out into their community to figure out how to engage people in a way that respects cultural protocol, that is Indigenous in nature, that is not. So even the way we have conversations has to be indigenized. It's not just enough to focus on the curriculum or, you know, who our staff and students are. Every single thing about the way we have conversations has to fundamentally change. So the two aspects of this project that I think I just want to highlight from an engaging and policymaking perspective. The first one, so engaging, I talked about. So this is the way we're going out and having conversations is different. So it often involves following protocol, having prayer, being led by an elder, as opposed to being led by, you know, a consultant like me. It's being led by somebody who's a knowledge keeper in perhaps the education. It often involves a feast where we bring people together around ceremony and culture and using that as the entry point into a conversation instead of sitting around a boardroom table and having an agenda and telling everybody you have 5 minutes to answer a question. We create the space and time for people to participate on their own terms. So instead of, for example, time dictating process, process dictates time in this process. The third project is from Edmonton. This is a really interesting project. So this is the river valley that we're crossing through this project. This is it's called the High Level Bridge. It's about 110 years old, and this is called the Menzies Bridge. The city of Edmonton is trying to meet some climate targets that it set for itself. So it's trying to expand its light rail transit network, so the train network in the city. It's currently doing detailed design and planning and construction for $10 billion Canadian of new transportation infrastructure. So a hugely important project. From a climate change perspective, it's a wonderful project. It's about getting cars off the road, making communities more transit oriented, getting people activated into public transit. But this landscape, this is the North Saskatchewan River. This has been a gathering place for essentially every major Indigenous cultural group in Alberta, what is now Alberta, for tens of thousands of years. So to do an activity as so simple as, from, you know, our transportation engineer perspective, of creating a new river crossing is much more complicated when we're talking about reconciliation. So in this project, this is the project manager right here, Satya. We're going out with 29 different Indigenous communities from all across the province to have conversations about the traditional values and the knowledge embedded on this landscape. So again, it's a large infrastructure project. One of the things that's innovative about this project is that historically in Canada, when a proponent, an industry proponent, or in this case, a government proponent, is gonna go and do a project, their, let's say, their referral radius, so who they have to talk to is dictated by the province. So the province would say, you need to engage these three communities because they're the most geographically proximate. What Edmonton has done is kind of taken that process back themselves to say, we should be engaging every community that has a historical and cultural connection to this place. So instead of engaging maybe four or five communities, they're engaging 29. So there is definitely no other community in Canada that's engaging 29 Indigenous communities on a regular basis on transportation policy, on what we're doing right now. It's called a municipal development plan. It's the largest kind of overarching policy framework for the entire municipality, and we're engaging 29 communities. So that's a fundamental change. When 10 years ago, a municipality engaging even one Indigenous community would have been seen as non-existent. It wouldn't have happened. So fundamentally, the biggest connections from land use planning and traditional knowledge are the way we're engaging. So it's not just who we're engaging, because we're engaging based on traditional territories, but we're also asking the Indigenous communities themselves how they would like to be engaged. We're paying honoraria, we're validating people as knowledge keepers and experts by compensating them for their time. The same way we would pay an engineer or an architect or an archaeologist for their knowledge, we're compensating people for their knowledge as well. We're holding ceremony before site visits, we're doing site visits. These are things that are being determined and led by Indigenous people. The other aspect that's quite interesting is that we're, similar to the other projects, we're creating a new layer of technical expertise. So it's not just, you know, a geotechnical assessment or an environmental assessment that is seen as expert knowledge that should inform where that river crossing should go. It's also traditional knowledge. So traditional knowledge, you know, elders and knowledge keepers are looking for different things than a botanist or a biologist or a fisheries specialist on the landscape. Oftentimes those, you know, expert environmental folks are looking for rare or endangered or at-risk species, whereas an elder might be looking for a more common species because more common species would perhaps have been more readily incorporated into ceremony or subsistence activities because you could find them everywhere. So the things that we're looking for and how that informs decision making are starting to change. And the final project, which I think is actually one of the more interesting ones that has been emerging in Canada recently, is this redevelopment project. So this, to explain that the really complicated geography in this kind of, you know, artist rendering, this is Quebec. This is the city of Gatineau. It has a French legal system. This is Ottawa. This is in Ontario with an English legal system. This is Parliament Hill. So this is where Canadian Parliament sits and the Supreme Court. This is it was an old pulp and paper mill, and there's a hydroelectric dam right here. So we have an incredibly contaminated site. These lands are managed by something called the National Capital Commission, which is responsible for all kind of federally significant lands in the capital region. So we have five different decision makers. We have two different legal traditions. We have two different linguistic groups, and that's just from the settler perspective. This land is also untreated, it's unceded territory of the Algonquin people. And this area has incredible significance. So this hydroelectric dam exists there because of the really, really unique hydrology and hydrogeology of the area. So it's called Chaudière Falls, and so that means cauldron falls in French. The water actually would go through this area into an underground seam and come out, you know, a few kilometers away, which was incredibly significant to the Algonquin people and has been for thousands of years. This area in the Ottawa River has also kind of been romanticized as one of the more significant meeting places or points of interaction between the European settlers and the Indigenous peoples in kind of those first encounters. So this is a very important area from many, many different perspectives. So the developer who's coming here has tried to honor that and engage beyond who it's being told to engage with, and they're actually engaging all of the Algonquin communities, both in Ontario and Quebec, I think it's about 19 communities, to find ways that those communities can actually be partners in the urban redevelopment project. So either as, you know, potential owners of aspects of the equity, incorporating cultural and linguistic aspects into the design of parks and open spaces. There's even a women's council that's created to be an advisory body to the developer on this project, following again the kind of Algonquin matrilineal system of community leadership. The challenge for this project is that, like many urban redevelopment projects, it often gets interrelated or intermixed into other broader community conversations. So this project has been quite challenged with a series of demonstrations because, well, from one perspective is that the wealthy landowners over here don't really want their view of Parliament Hill blocked. They don't want 30,000 more people living in their backyard. So they've aligned themselves with what they see to be an indigenous cause, that these are sacred lands, they shouldn't be redeveloped. When in fact, they're being kind of redeveloped. They were already developed 100 years ago. People are using this project as kind of a launching point for anti-capitalism, anti-globalism conversations. And really, there are, I've been at one of these protests, there are very, very few indigenous peoples actually at these protests. Most indigenous peoples in this region, maybe not speaking for the folks who actually live in Ottawa, but the regional communities, they could probably care less. They're focused on education, they're focused on youth suicide, they're focused on any other number of issues or projects, and this is the last of the concerns. Which has been one of the biggest challenges for the proponent of this project, is how do you reach out to those communities and make this of interest? There's a huge opportunity here to be equity partners or economic partners, from procurement to employment to actually owning land on this very valuable piece of real estate. But if it's not top of mind, then no one's going to take up on that offer. But the exercise of creating that space for Indigenous peoples to be partners in an urban redevelopment project is kind of a one-of-a-kind thing, but it's starting to be more of a trend in Canada. So that's one of its innovations, is trying to create the space for Indigenous peoples and communities to be owners of the outcome. Tangible owners, but also owners of kind of the benefits of redevelopment, so employment, skills training, procurement, and even urban design. And the second piece is activating the existing knowledge and culture and community values that exist in the landscape and embedding those into the redevelopment. So instead of taking what we, again, assume to be a blank canvas and saying, oh, we can make this an area that's focused on, significant men in history, why not take the value that already exists there in terms of Algonquin language and storytelling and women's voices and incorporate those into the way we design public space? So to wrap all of this up, I know I'm talking quite a bit, so I'll try to be fast. So to wrap this up, I think there's kind of four interesting takeaways from the way that we're starting to see ethical space created in planning and traditional knowledge finding its way into planning, is that firstly, Indigenous peoples are now being seen as active partners in these projects. They're not being seen as kind of token aspects where we'll take a couple words and we'll put those as a couple road names. It's actually becoming real equity partners in the outcomes of these projects. They're being empowered to actually co-design and implement aspects of projects. So they're being asked how they would like to be engaged, on what terms they'd like to be engaged, who should be engaged. We're also creating ethical space in these projects where the knowledge systems and the information being kind of collected together flows in both directions. So it's not just one proponent of a project saying, we're going to search for knowledge in this area, is we're going to create the space for Indigenous knowledge to also enhance the work done by engineers or environmental set assessors. And the last one, which I think is probably the most important, is that these projects, because they're located in high population areas, actually make reconciliation as a concept more real. So people, students at Bow Valley College who may not be Indigenous, who may not know about this project, will start to see aspects of it emerge, both in the courses they take or maybe in who's teaching classes or elders being brought into classes as experts in areas, and starting to see how things have changed. Or, a person walking in the River Valley in Lethbridge is going to start to see Indigenous historical sites identified and interpreted by Indigenous peoples, reaffirming that this is an Indigenous landscape. And it's not a way of kind of threatening the narrative of the history that's been told in that landscape for the last 100 years. It actually adds to it. And that's quite powerful. And people can start to see how they themselves can change the narratives that they see, or the narratives that they tell, the way that they imagine their space. And it all trickles out into the community, and it's much more tangible.
Thank you. Really interesting insights into how these ideas of reconciliation and indigenization are being put into practice in Canada. I don't want to take up too much time speaking this up, but rather turn it over to all of you to take any questions or comments, reflections you might have for Perry.
Can I keep up? It's going to be a complicated question.
I'll take notes.
I suppose that what brought to mind Barry from your presentation was a reflection on André Lefebvre's production of space. And the kind of French theorist looking at production of space not as geographical space, but spaces of knowledge and space of interaction and so on. And I just was contrasting your project in Edmonton, was that the one with the curriculum or the Calgary one, where it is about the curriculum and it's about processes involved in those not just having members of staff and students, but also the way in which meetings are held, to the one in Ottawa, where the vision or the impression by the designer is so modernist that you relegate, or that one relegates the indigenization to aspects of public space or symbols and so on and so forth. And what if that entire space was representational of indigenous, of an indigenous being? None of those bright lights, none of those buildings, darkness, the notions about the land, the sky, the earth, all coming together. Sometimes I find that there's kind of contradictions. And in the kind of understandings we have of radical planning or insurgent planning is often in these fringe aspects of development that we tend to look at. And to what extent do they actually get mainstreamed? But even if they get mainstreamed as in that project, the spaces within which they are articulated tend to be the spaces where there's less tension or there's less conflict around values. Yeah. There's the actual buildings itself. Because ultimately the project has to generate its own capital and it has to be sustainable financially. Yeah. And I think there's that contradiction. And I think there's a huge amount of work that you've done in terms of incorporating a lot of these perspectives. But they still, that's something I'm tussling with. Mm-hmm. That we tinker at the margins of policy, dig at the margins of redevelopment, and we're not talking about the rights to those places in general. Especially given the proportion of indigenous populations you've explained, 10, 15, 20%, they're sizable. Mm-hmm. They're not small 2% here and so on and so forth.
That's always the challenge, is how do you have visible and meaningful impacts without resorting to tokenism? And putting a name on a park is arguably just tokenism. The context is that even the tokenism never existed. So the tokenism is in and of itself a fundamental shift. But that interesting project in Ottawa, basically when the communities were presented with that project as an opportunity to be involved, there was a very minimal design at that site. And that the challenge was communities, I don't think, could see themselves connected to that. They had never been engaged on most of those communities. I should have showed a map of the Algonquin territory, but most of those communities, some of which are several hundred kilometers away from that site, had never been engaged on any projects in that geography, let alone an urban development project. So the challenge was, how do you make that real and important? And that has been a big challenge of the proponent of that project, the developer. The other challenge in that is that we have to imagine the entry points for indigenous communities as being dynamic too. So the contemporary needs of an indigenous community may not be, we don't really care about the design of the site. We want ownership of it. We want to own, you know, a performing arts center at that site as an embassy of Algonquin people in Ottawa. And that's something that was, in that area, has historically been seen as, there was a vision of a famous architect, an elder, who imagined that those islands, Victorian Island and Shorty Ear Island, being an embassy of Algonquin people in Ottawa, to be the place where they express their territoriality, to take back aspects of the landscape that have been taken from them. So tokenism is important, I think. It's a good place to start, but also not limiting the entry points of indigenous people into the conversation, because we often get trapped into, let's talk about language and culture and education, and the indigenous communities will say, no, let's talk about equity ownership and procurement. We don't want just a token skills training program. We want to own the thing at the end. And so there are, I would say, more resource development companies who have started to shift in that direction, doing projects where they'll own an equity stake, 50% in the project out front, and the equity created by the indigenous community through the generation of the energy or whatever it might be, actually buy back the project and take full equity ownership of that project in 20 years. So private development from a resource extraction and kind of processing perspective, many cases have been leaders in that, but these urban environments have been laggards. They haven't done anything. So the little symbolic things is seen as kind of a start, but I agree with it, it's complete tokenism.
But I think that equity is a very interesting idea. But it's in a kind of sense moved indigenous populations into that arena of monetary value. Yeah. So you see, I'm just thinking of all the kind of contradictions that we are dealing with.
Yeah.
And that's, of course, they are seeing those monetary values in the context in which they are. And what else can they reclaim?
Yeah.
But also, even that equity then fixes the flexibility around that process. I mean, I think it's mm-hmm. some very interesting kind of philosophical and ethical, large ethical questions it raises about the trade-offs that we have to achieve with these options.
And many communities in Canada are maybe more interested in traditional outcomes, and others are in a different place in their story and looking for, you know, we're already here. There's a famous chief from the Okanagan Band named Chief Clarence Louis, and he talks about economic development is the horse that drives the socio-cultural cart. We don't have language programs, we don't have cultural rejuvenation programs if we don't have income and economic sovereignty. So I think that's the place that many communities are at, is how do we create economic sovereignty, remove ourselves from the confines of the federal government's legislative framework, and create our own paths forward. But that's within, at least in Canada right now, that's within a capitalist scenario.
Sure.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of thoughts about this. I'm not really sure where to start. But I come from Australia. And I have an Indigenous background, and I've been involved in Aboriginal land councils and various things, and have been involved in some of these projects from the Indigenous side. And I think maybe reflecting on the Australian experience, I think we're probably like a number of years behind what's happening in Canada. And I think we're probably still at that point of colonisation where Indigenous knowledge is being denied or kind of destroyed in some cases. And I can't think of any kind of equivalent examples where it's being incorporated into policy or these kinds of things. But I was kind of interested in what the role of the kind of legal framework that shapes the Canadian Indigenous experience plays in this process. So in Australia there's no treaty, and I think, I'm not sure about the comparisons to the kind of native title or land ownership situation in Canada, but our Indigenous title is quite weak, I would say, particularly in more urban parts of the country. So I was wondering, like, to what extent do these kind of legal frameworks, I guess, provide a point of leverage for Indigenous communities, and then also how much they kind of shape the culture around reconciliation to the extent that, like, these to create a kind of framework for these things to kind of happen. Like, I'm just interested in why in the last 10 years has this kind of picked up? Why now, essentially?
So there's maybe a couple answers to that. The first one is there's a lawyer in Canada named Bill Gallagher who's been tracking First Nations court cases over the last number of years. And the outcome is 250 in favor of Indigenous communities and zero in favor of resource extracting companies or, you know, private sector corporations in terms of the upholding of traditional territory and Indigenous rights over those territories. So the legal system is definitely slanting in favor of Indigenous communities, and I think that's played out in the way that private sector has interacted with Indigenous communities. So every major pipeline or energy transmission company or resource extraction company in Canada has an Indigenous relations department or Aboriginal relations staff person whose job it is to build those relationships, often around equity, around jobs, around procurement, around employment, around creating tangible benefits back to the communities in whose traditional territories those projects are working. From an urban perspective, there has been no similar kind of string of court cases or legislation that pushes local governments to have a relationship with even a First Nation community who shares a physical border with the community. There is none. It's slowly starting to change, but really all of this work is based on good faith, understanding that it's important to have a relationship. And a lot of this has come in the last 5 or 6 years with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, different levels of government encouraging, never at this point it's not legislating, but it's encouraging cities, for example, to reach out and build relationships. But again, there's no kind of legal structure. All of this is happening on goodwill at the moment. So for example, in Alberta, so the province where Lethbridge and Edmonton and Calgary are located, there is the Municipal Government Act, which says municipalities must notify an adjoining municipality when they intend to create a neighborhood plan or a community plan that will impact the neighbor. So that municipality will send notice, hopefully have a meeting. We used to call them going for tea. We go sit down and we talk about the project, understand what the implications for each other might be. If you had a border with a First Nation community or a Métis community, there was never the same legislative requirement to even notify that community of a project. Now we're seeing that really hasn't changed very much, but you're seeing municipalities take the initiative regardless of what the legislative framework is. So Edmonton is a great example. So they would be told on that transportation project that they probably would have to notify nobody. It doesn't matter. Because that project, that infrastructure project, is receiving money from the federal government, the duty to consult, it's called in Canada, is being passed on to that municipality, and they maybe have to engage two or three communities, one of which has a physical border with Edmonton. So Edmonton has gone above and beyond that because they value the relationship, but also they see the importance and the value created by incorporating the knowledge of those communities into the design of the project. But there is no legal imperative. So it's a bit of an interesting space that you have private sector in Canada, which has a legal imperative to seek out the perspectives and engage and consult with Indigenous communities, but there is no similar legal requirement for perhaps the level of government that has the most day-to-day impact on every single person's lives. And regardless of the fact that you have communities where you have 10, 20, 30% of the community self-identifies as being Indigenous, that there's, with rights, there is no similar legislative requirement to understand how a project in that geography will impact someone's constitutional rights that doesn't exist yet. So it's interesting that it's all happening relatively on good faith.
Hello. What I was looking at
reminded me very much of the Native Americans, but they were extremely hostile towards any sort of development planning in America. So my first question is, do you find that when you go to these tribes that they are willing to agree with what you're presenting, or is it more of a case that because they actually haven't come to you with ideas, that you're sort of imposing developmental ideas on them as the sort of superior, and then you're trying to come to terms with an agreement where they never wanted it in the first place, they just want to be left alone?
I would say that there are very, at least in the places that I work, there are very few communities who want to be left alone. Because they have, because not all of the members of that community necessarily live in that reserve or American reservation. That, so for example, in Edmonton, those 29 communities being engaged in their projects from all across, you know, a place that geography the size of France being engaged on a project in Paris, for example. They have members who live in that community. They have members who will take public transportation. They have historical interests in that river valley. So they want to be engaged on those projects. Not every community is ready, I would say, to be engaged, maybe from a capacity perspective, or there are other more significant priorities that deserve their time. These are relatively small communities with limited resources, limited capacity often, because they're being bombarded with project proponents all over the place. So a municipal project tends to have lower interest and lower standing than a hydro development project. For that would be a lot more interesting to be involved in. Your point about the cities and others always coming to them asking for input, that's the point around that I mentioned around paying honorarium. So these communities are constantly bombarded with proponent after proponent seeking, we need your wisdom, we need your knowledge, we need your advice, tell us about this project, tell us about this project. And without any recompense to say, my knowledge is worth something. When they would go out and pay a geologist $1,000 a day to tell them about the geography of a river. So there's a shift in terms of the compensation of the value of time and the value of knowledge being given to indigenous communities, which encourages their interest in participating because they see some sort of respect that's coming in those conversations. I think the direction that a lot of these communities are, like the municipal communities are hoping these relationships go in is it's not just, you know, the city coming to the nation saying, we have this project, we'd like to know what your perspectives are on it. It's, we would like to see the indigenous communities come to us and saying, we have a project, we would like to have your perspective on it. Perhaps your engineers can look at some of our drawings and give us their perspective on something, or maybe you have a design for a stormwater management system that we can incorporate into our community plan. So it's that creating of that ethical space that I talked about, where it's not just information flowing in one direction, the proponent going to the indigenous community, taking knowledge to make their outcomes better, that there's at some point a dynamic where information flows in both directions that everybody gains from. Because right now it is very unidirectional. The information tends to flow in one direction, but it is starting to shift.
Thanks.
Fundamental point there, the difference between invited spaces and invented spaces. So if the communities are able to approach people with things that they would want and to see how others can participate, that's the invented space. The invited spaces is the last critique around participation, that you create those spaces. And I think even while we take the point about paying for this contribution, could also be the danger that since you've been paid, this is the service you're providing.
Right.
And that kind of questioning rather than the one of actual interaction, the braiding that you talk about is less involving those kind of resources. Something to think about.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah, my
question
is also on participation and how you account for intersectional differences within the indigenous communities.
Yeah.
Because whilst I assume the community leaders are respected and kind of at the forefront of what they want for their communities, how do you account for the voices that may not be heard and their agendas that might not be pushed? So, yeah.
Absolutely. So intersectionality is a really critical aspect of all of this, because it's not like the community has one specific voice. There are multiple voices in So when we try to design engagement from the perspective of the indigenous community, so empowering them to say, this is how we would like to be engaged, often how that comes back to us is, we would like you to engage our youth, we'd like you to engage our elders, and we'd like you to engage women. And though this might happen in different contexts, to allow that knowledge to be shared fulsomely. So in some indigenous communities, women are empowered with different types of knowledge than men are, but that they might defer to the men in a certain context when they're in the same room. So we've had a project, it's not one of the projects listed on here, but it's essentially a cultural space that's being designed, and we've been we're kind of the facilitators, and it's being designed from an indigenous perspective, both in terms of its architecture, but also the programming of the space and how the governance structure of the space. And the wisdom back from the community was, you need to have an elder's tea or a smoke ceremony. And this is how it happens. And you ask a question to the male elders, and you ask a question to the female elders. And those processes are separate, and that's the wisdom, and that's the preferences of the community. So from an intersectional perspective, we let the communities dictate what that looks like to the facilitator of the conversation.
But then how do you ensure that behind the scenes during that kind of discussion that you might not be present in, that everyone in that community comes to the agreement, rather than it being, I don't know, the community leader who comes to you with the project plan?
Yeah, it's challenging. So when I did my work in a kind of an urban, like a municipal government, we would try to incorporate like a gender-based analysis lens on the way we would do public engagement. So what are the barriers to participation in the conversation about this project? How do you design engagement so that everyone has an equal opportunity to participate? So there are very few, if no, barriers to participation. When we're engaging with indigenous communities, to come to the community and say, no, we want to tell you that everybody gets a voice, that we're going to do online engagements, everybody can have a conversation, we're going to do it at the rec center, we're going to do it at the sports center. It comes across as being an imposition of external will. So while indigenous communities may not have the same perspectives on inclusion and intersectionality as maybe the dominant society in this context, we have to at this point respect the traditional ways of doing it, because we're trying to create the space for those conversations to take place. And I think that's where the ethical space is quite interesting, because perhaps there's something in there where we can all contribute something. So it doesn't always work very well, but we often have feedback coming that's dominated by male elders, which is not that dissimilar from how we do things in local government, where typically the old white guys who have the strongest voice in the conversation. But we are not the ones empowering how that conversation takes place. It's the indigenous communities themselves. So it's a reassertion of a traditional form of governance or community decision making that's being empowered, but it may not be as inclusive as I think we would find in other contexts. It's a real challenge.
Great, I think we need to wrap it up there, unless there's any last burning questions. Great. Well, please join me.